We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. Today, we are in music class to talk about music and fantasy in the Harry Potter franchise. Welcome to Potterversity. Today, we are in music class with Dr. Daniel White. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of Comparative Religions and Cultural Competency at Mount Carmel College, and co-editor with Katie of that book that she just named.
Potterversity. It's
Potterversity.
Easy to remember
yes,
the name.
Say it again. It's free advertisement.
And it is available for purchase. And we hope that you all will pick up a copy of that, enjoy it. And we have companion podcast episodes that we have already released that you can listen to as we talk with the authors of the chapters in that book. So we are very excited to have that out there in the world now. Today, we are going to explore the music of the Harry Potter series, from the films to the play The Cursed Child, and even the music at various theme parks used in the games and so on. So, Emily, as we were sort of thinking about this episode, I was thinking about how, you know, we have this sense that the movies are often really different from the book series and so on, but I was really curious, you're also very musical, has the music of the Harry Potter films shaped the way that you experience the series, like even the books?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It certainly has. I'm not sure if I've ever kind of bothered to mentally or verbally articulate how, you know what I mean? It's such a foundational part of the experience. And I was just thinking as you were introducing the episode that this is really long overdue, you know, for
yes.
us to talk about the music. And I can't believe, you know, and we're centrally concerned with the music. You know, we had a lot of conversations about our podcast music, which I ended up leading the charge on with my band from Cincinnati, The Town, which everybody always hears in the ending credits. Shame on you if you don't listen to the ending credits, because then the musicians get acknowledged there. So I've thought about the music so much. I've played with the music. I've kind of tried to reinvent the music for the podcast. But I can't wait to talk about and to learn myself how music has even shaped my own experience as a books fan. I'm definitely more of a books fan than a films fan, but they've been the soundtrack of my life, you know, for the past 20 years. Every time I need comfort or just a wonderful background music that makes me feel that sense of kind of awe and transcendence, I put on the music. And so I can't wait to talk with Dan about it today. Katie, what do you think about the music? How has it impacted your experience of Harry Potter?
Yeah, I love your words, awe and transcendence. I think those kind of hit it when you were talking about it's hard to even put into words. There's something kind of atavistic. This is what I think about music in general. It's such a core part of what it is to be human. And I don't always think that we even realize what it's doing to us because it goes beyond words in a way. And I was thinking about when I hear, you know, the intro music, right? I just feel like I'm going into the portal of the portal fantasy, you know, it just brings me right in it. So during COVID times, very stressful, right? You couldn't go anywhere and yet stress, stress, stress. And so I just started playing.
The stress is from within.
Right. It's coming from inside the house. So I started just sight reading popular music, you know, just funny popular music, you know, playing some of the hits or whatever. And I really realized it was a good stress reliever to just bang out some stuff, and it didn't matter how it sounded. And I, of course, got Harry Potter sheet music that I could, you know, bang around on. And I would have the same experience there. And in the week or so before we were recording, I was playing around and playing the Harry Potter stuff, and I even have some of the Fantastic Beasts music. And let me tell you, this music is not easy to play. There's
No,
all
yeah.
those sharps and the rhythm changes.
And
It's a lot.
right. They do they there's a lot. John Williams keeps it very interesting by making these subtle changes that you don't notice almost until you go to play the music, and then you're like, "Oh, hey, that's different this time," you know. So.
Yeah, right. It's not the same sharp every time you play that little thing. And so, even through all the stumbling that I was doing, I get that happy, excited feeling. It just sort of translates. And I associate that, I guess, with my excitement about when the movie was first coming out all those many years ago. And then every other time I've heard that, it's presaged something really kind of wonderful. And I mean that in the wonderful way.
Yeah,
It's,
definitely.
yeah. And I agree with you that
I'm
it's overdue that we talk about
right.
it.
I'm having trouble even remembering a time before I was aware of this music. The film advertisements, you know, the film is coming, those are what part of what made me want to read the books when they were then handed to me in the midst of that. And I think maybe one film had already been out, so I hadn't read, you know, there's already a film out and I hadn't read the books yet. So I read the books, caught up to that, and then you know, follow the progression of the film. So like, I don't, they were just always part of it for me. And also, you know, that's what's so great is you can get mad at the films for not being, you know, as I often do, for not being as faithful as you wanted them to be to the books, but you can't get mad at the music for that because the music is just as like, that's, it's perfect. It's just exactly, you know, the way that I envision this world. And it's giving me exactly the mood, you know, that the world invites me to. So,
You know, that's so interesting, and I bet you're like most of our listeners in that the music was there already when you were reading the books. But I, and I'm sure some of our other listeners are like this. Like, I read the first few books before any movies had come out at all. And so when you were saying it's hard to remember, like when I first read the books, like I didn't have that as part of the soundtrack in the back of my mind. And so, but I can't remember what that would have been like. It seems to fit so perfectly that I can even retroactively put it back into my memories.
Yeah, like I know my Harry is a little different because I think of Harry as being tall and
Yeah,
thin, you
me
know,
too.
and especially toward the end of the series, and I can always sub him back in, you
Yeah,
know,
and Hermione
to
too. Yeah.
and Hermione too, right, exactly, but the music is just always there. Well,
Yeah,
let's
well,
get to it.
cool. Yes, let's get to it. Right. We were so excited that we just already got deep into it there, I think. But we
We
are going to
fangirled.
be, yes, right. We are going to be guided and directed in our conversation by our expert today, who is a music professor. He's going to help us to understand all of this at a more sophisticated level. And so we are very glad to welcome to the show today Dr. Daniel White. He is senior
Hi.
lecturer in musicology at the University of Huddersfield in West Yorkshire, England, where he teaches film music, popular music studies, fandom and identity, research skills, and performance. He has written quite a lot about the music of various film universes, including Jurassic Park and Middle Earth, but also the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. His forthcoming book, The Music of Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings, Sounds of Home in the Fantasy Franchise. Ooh, I just need a little ooh, that sounds great. It will be published in May 2024 as part of the Ashgate Screen Music Series. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really, really pleased to be able to talk about the music of this particular world. And like you said, it's not that it's been long overdue, but I'm really pleased to be here for the moment that we are talking about the music. So yeah.
Yeah, well, I heard your talk at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference last fall, and it was one of those where it was just like, why haven't we talked about this before? But how wonderful that we have somebody who's just the perfect person to have on to lead us through this. And I enjoyed reading the work of yours that's already out. Although by the time this podcast comes out, I think that your book will at least be nearly on the doorstep, so people won't have to wait too long for that. But really excited to
Hopefully,
have
yeah.
you here. Yeah. So,
Thank
how did you
you.
first get interested in looking at the music of fantasy realms? Do you think of yourself as a fan of fantasy works like Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter?
Yeah, I would probably consider myself a fan to some extent, or Henry Jenkins calls it an acca-fan, so somewhere
Right.
between academia and fandom, right? And yeah, I got into it. I'm a musician. I've been interested in film music since I was a teenager, really, and kind of just listening to film scores and just found it really engaging and kind of exciting to think about. My bachelor's dissertation was on minimalism in film. And then in my master's, my thesis was about exoticism in fantasy film, particularly. So I kind of slowly edged my way into kind of the fantasy world. And then my PhD thesis was kind of a precursor to the book. So it focused largely on Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings as two kind of the really the biggest and most prominent fantasy franchises and outside of the film, but where music was doing something that I saw as being significant and noteworthy. So that's kind of how I got into studying these particular worlds, Harry Potter included.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And we'll talk a little bit about how you compare those two fantasy universes, because there's so much of a, an overlap in the fandoms of those two fantasy series. But I'm also interested if you have thoughts on the sort of what Emily and I were talking about. Like, do you think that the music influenced the way that you were, reading the books as you were getting into them?
It's really interesting. Yeah, I think I read them when I was pretty young, and so I think it will have been the first couple of books that I read before having seen the first film, which is what, 2001. And so yeah, similarly, it's hard to remember being decades ago, but I think that there's a kind of an overlap between how I imagined the world to be and then how it was depicted to me in the films. And so I think music maybe can also kind of smooth over and blur is part of blurring that kind of line. I like what you said, Emily, that actually the music, it doesn't have to it kind of stands up to scrutiny because there's no right or wrong in terms of how the music should sound. This is just one interpretation. And but I think, and we'll probably get onto it even more, like John Williams and his role in creating or instigating, like, this is the music of this wizarding world. This is how it sounds in the first film and then in the next two films that he scored as well. It's just there's so much world building in the music in that first film in Philosopher's Stone that is just really, really interesting because it sounds really, really like John Williams. You know, there's other elements where that's recognizable. There's kind of precursors to that world and in terms of his instrumentation or the kind of the different things that he does. But then it does sound like its own world. It sounds kind of enchanted and childlike and wondrous, yeah, and exciting and all of those things. Really thinking about what music comes after John Williams, the rest of the composers were so tied to the world that he created because of the strength of the world building, I think, because of how evocative it is. And that also comes through people's feelings about it, you know, like people started to become so attached to Harry Potter as a world and as a kind of a narrative, but also to the films that the music and the soundtrack started to become such a kind of an ever-present sort of prevalent part of kind of culture, really. Like they were so recognizable, they were kind of everywhere. And so it's because of that that, you know, the world building was so strong in what John Williams created that the rest of the composers kind of had to grapple with that and wrestle with that to some extent. But
Yeah, and that's
yeah,
not true
it's
of
all
every series. Like, if you think about, like, Batman has lots of different, things that it does, right? Because it didn't hook in right at first. And that's just the one I thought of, but I'm sure there are other ones. But that's interesting. And that even the ones like the Fantastic Beasts, I was playing one of the themes from that. I can't remember which one, but it's very Harry Potter, right? It's still a riff on that sound.
It's really interesting because I think Fantastic Beasts does something quite interesting as well. James Newton Howard, each of the Fantastic Beasts films, or at least the first two, start with Hedwig's theme, you know, the main kind of ding 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 that everyone is already singing. They open with that as if to say, yes, we are back in the wizarding world. You know, Hedwig's theme by that point has been used in seven other films to lead us into the world and say, here's the wizarding world again. And it's like a shorthand, you know, it kind of automatically conjures and brings you along that same path and says, you're back in this world. Let's pick up where we left off. Here's what you need to know, kind of thing. And so, yeah, the Fantastic Beasts films, they use Hedwig's theme and say, yes, we're kind of in the Wizarding World, and then immediately replace it with a brand new theme from James Newton Howard, dead films, to lead us into the world and say, here's the Wizarding World again. And it's like a shorthand, it kind of automatically conjures and brings you along that same path and says, you're back in this world, let's pick up where we left off, here's what you need to know, kind of thing. And so, yeah, the Fantastic Beasts films, they use Hedwig's theme and say, yes, we're kind of in the Wizarding World, and then immediately replace it with a brand new theme from James Newton Howard. And yeah, but it's doing similar things. It's playing with kind of chromaticism. It's playing with, the instruments and stuff that he uses orchestrally are quite similar, I think. Well, the way he uses the orchestral instruments is at times quite similar. So yeah, James Newton Howard. It does a really interesting job because the music in Fantastic Beasts enables him to be a bit more playful. There's like some jazz, a bit more kind of jazz than we've heard in kind of the New York speakeasy stuff. There's some kind of Eastern influences when it goes over to like Bhutan. There's other influences he's allowed to play with it a little bit more. Yeah, I could say loads. It's really interesting.
Yeah, no.
He's further afield, but it almost strikes me. I've often thought about how, those first two films directed by Chris Columbus and the casting, especially the first film, and how he kind of set this. People love to poke fun at those films because, they're very kind of juvenile, and they're, some of the special effects are not working well, and but the casting, made this indelible mark on the franchise, and everybody had to cope with it moving forward. Some people got to do some new things, but everybody had to cope with that casting moving forward, and in some way, and to maximize it, and in a similar way, John Williams lays this foundation, this musical foundation that then everybody copes with, as they go forward, and again, in really productive ways, but it's there, and it can't be denied.
Yeah, I think we're all kind of answering the next question that I have here. But my next question is basically like, is this really special music? Was it that it was a phenomenon and so we made it special, or is this just doing a really good job of what this music is supposed to do? What's your, like, as a professional, what's your expert opinion on, the success of particularly what John Williams, but then also his successors did there?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think it's to an extent, I think it's both, and I think that the music is noteworthy and for a number of reasons, but it also became more prominent and more kind of widespread and widely kind of celebrated and listened to because of the kind of explosion of Harry Potter like around the world really. And so I think, like I said before, John Williams created something which is not too dissimilar from some of his other scores previously, but at the same time, the way in which he, I think, created a series of themes and motifs that just apply so well and so readily, and they capture something. It's a combination of so many simple things. So Hedwig's theme, his use of what we call chromaticism, so notes outside of the kind of diatonic scale. So if you think of any, if it was in C major or A minor, the white notes on a piano, any of those black notes would be considered chromatic. And so
That's what
his use
makes
of
it hard to
chromaticism
play.
in
That's what makes it
it
hard
does,
to play on
yeah.
the
It's tricky
piano.
under the fingers. So the
But also
chromaticism in Hedwig's
interesting.
theme.
But also
Yeah, it's the
interesting.
interest. It's the color. It's the kind of all the evocative stuff, the little chromatic movements, and just the larger kind of intervals between some of the notes. It's just all super interesting. It just makes it kind of sound a little bit enchanted, a little bit wondrous, and that's also paired with other things. So the instrumentation, the use of the celesta, whatever you call it, which is like a little piano but with bells inside. So that's what is the twinkling kind of sound that we hear. Interestingly, the first time we hear Hedwig's theme is over the Warner Brothers kind of blue image, and it's actually horns the first time we hear it, and we only have half of it, and then we have the prologue, and then it's only comes later on in Philosopher's Stone where we have it on the celesta. The second film, it opens with Hedwig's theme on the celesta. Like this is the magical version. This is what we want to hear. But anyway, I think it is noteworthy. Like I said, the world building is such a key part of how the world is created and introduced to us, and so how it feels, and then moving forward, the world can't change. It does change, but what's interesting, if we talk a bit later about the theme park stuff and some of the other video game stuff, that there tends to be much more use of the Williams soundtracks, particularly from the first two films, maybe the third one as well. That's a bit of a departure. There's much more use of that kind of, like we said, childlike, maybe even juvenile, kind of wondrous, enchanted music than there is of the music of the other composers, which does feature here and there, but that music tends to be slightly darker, more kind of grown up or adult in tone, you know, a bit more serious, a little bit more threat, even though there are kind of touching, safe, sentimental moments. But yeah, I think John Williams's music really becomes a touchstone for the series. So it's good at what it does because of how familiar it's become, I think.
Yeah, what's interesting to me about that is, we were talking about, Emily, you were talking about how the Chris Columbus films, they're more child-oriented. And I think even the book, The Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets, they're a little bit more in that realm of children's book. And I wonder if part of that, one of the things that you argue in one of the papers that I read, Dan, is that there's this nostalgic quality. And I've been doing some nostalgia research, and childhood is so connected with nostalgia. And I wonder if it's that childlike quality, right? As you say, the later ones, they're darker, they're more adult, they're bittersweet in a way that is maybe not, we want our nostalgia to do all that work for us, and are not maybe so drawn emotionally to those, more sophisticated sounds. I don't know, I'm just putting that out there. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think so much of fandom related to the world of Harry Potter particularly is related to nostalgia because of the point the story starts. It starts at the beginning of secondary school, as we would call it. You know, it starts at like you know, it's basically a gradual coming of age and going out into the world and identity formation and you know, overcoming good and evil. But amongst that, it's about friends and family and home and things like that. And so nostalgia is tied very much to identity and to home and you know, independence and things like that. So all of that tied together, the music of that first film, it's like Harry's introduction not only to like a new school or a new way of life, but it's a whole new world and a whole new community and all of those things again tied together. It makes sense that the music would in a sense already sound full of nostalgia. It also has this sense of, to an extent, a kind of a history and an oldness and then a kind of an archaic sound, which I think is kind of picked up even more in The Prisoner of Azkaban. So John Williams's score for The Prisoner of Azkaban starts to play really interestingly with sounds that we haven't heard really yet in the world. So that includes some early music sounds. It's got like some recorders and sackbuts and shawms and things like this. It also includes jazz for the first time, really, and all the music for the night bus. All of that music is scored like proper kind of big band jazz, and some other kind of orchestral colors and like really foregrounded percussion and things. And yeah, maybe that's because the film starts to take quite a different sort of directorial turn, in terms of it's quite different in tone already with Alfonso Cuarón as opposed to Chris Columbus. But
And is that the one that has the double, double toil and trouble song in it too?
yes,
And so
yes,
that's very
yeah.
different. I remember that. And that became like that was the song that you heard in a lot of the trailers and everything. And of course, that's Shakespeare. Like that's definitely reaching back into some kind of archaic thing. But then it's choral music that's a little bit
It's choral
different.
and it's very early music. There's something I told Dan before we started that I'm a Catholic church musician, and so I get so jazzed up when you put something that is 1500 years old right next to something that is 50 years old, and especially when it's like chant and then jazz, So like I get super excited about these things happening in church, and when they ha you know when they were happening in that film, I was just I mean there was some kind of magic to that alchemy of putting those two influences back to back, that it just made that film, it shifted the tone so beautifully. I would have just loved to see what John Williams would do next, but I wasn't part of that decision. No one consulted me.
It's interesting, and as well, because Prisoner of Azkaban is so much about time travel and different, you know, different understandings of kind of time as well, that it makes sense to have like, yeah, some older musical influences and some more modern influences in there, and
Right,
the
all
world starts
jumbled
to get
up.
bigger as well. You know, it's the first time that we really get outside Hogwarts and Hogsmeade, and the world starts to kind of expand. And you know, to that point, by the seventh film, we don't have Hogwarts at all. It all happens out in the wide world, and that's interesting musically as well. Hedwig's theme, We can think of it as like dun 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 dun, but I think there's three parts to it. So that's the first part. The second part is kind of the second half of that first iteration. Dun, 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 dun. And interestingly, that second part generally is much more tied to Hogwarts, to the school. Every time, really, in the first three films, and then in many of the films later on, you get anytime there's a kind of an aerial shot of Hogwarts, you know, like it's an owl flying around, or we're arriving by boat across the lake. Every time the camera pans and we see Hogwarts, we get that dun 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 dun. And so it's really indelibly tied to the school, and to the community, to the extent that in the eighth film, the last film, Alexander Desplat brings that back in two particular moments. So in the first moment, where we have that second half of Hedwig's theme for Hogwarts, is when Harry and whoever else kind of comes through the secret passageway into the Room of Requirement. And it's like they return for the first time for a long time to Hogwarts. And we get that dun 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 dun. We haven't heard it at all the last couple of films.
And you know the
Really.
emotional resonance of that. I mean, I think people
Oh.
feel it. You feel it. And I guess
Huge.
it's because they've been missing Hogwarts, and it's so unlike all the other books, right? All the other parts of the series, in that you don't have that. And then you're going back, and
I
it's
just
such
got
a
chills.
climactic moment.
Just got chills.
I know.
Well, I mean, you like that. The second time that we hear it is at the point where McGonagall, Maggie Smith, she's had a bit of a duel with Snape, and she kind of banishes him out the window, whatever. And it's the point where she lights the kind of the lamps, you know, she lights the fires or whatever, and puts the drapes back into the Great Hall. And that's the point where we hear like dun 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 dun. And again, the emotional kind of resonance and response to that. If you think about people who have been watching these films for nearly a decade, they're familiar with the music, but even if they're not kind of consciously familiar of what the music might be linked to, kind of thematically or motivically, when we see, you know, Hogwarts kind of come back to some of its former glory, and we hear that, you know, that's what makes it even stronger, that emotional kind of response to seeing that is like, yes, and it sounds like Hogwarts again, you know, like Hogwarts is fighting back. It's like it wants us to fight back, that kind of thing. So the music does some super interesting things. And then the third part of Hedwig's theme is kind of what I would see as the third part. And there's another analyst called Jamie Lynn Webster who's written about Harry Potter music as well. She's got a great chapter in a book called The Music of Fantasy Cinema. She identifies this third part as so it's a time change, but it's still kind of sort of a part of Hedwig's theme. And we don't hear that much in the third film in Prisoner of Azkaban, but that's because I think it sort of becomes replaced by double, double, toil and trouble, because they're very, very, it's very similar kind
Yeah,
of
they are.
harmonically, motivically. And so it sort of gets replaced by the other. But they're all kind of still there. From film four onwards, really, Hedwig's theme gets kind of relegated just to the opening credits, maybe the closing credits, maybe a couple of other points here and there. But obviously, we've got Nick Cooper, Patrick Doyle for four, Nick Cooper for five and six, Alexander Desplat for seven and eight. And they each do things, use Hedwig's theme specifically for different reasons and at different
Right.
points.
So
But
why don't you walk us through some of those changes? I mean, we've already seen you've given us kind of the bookends there, and thinking about the John Williams version of Hedwig's theme. But one of the things that I heard you talk about in the fall was the sort of changes that other composers made to it along the way, and how, you know, it is supplanted by some other kind of themes that come through. And so can you walk us through, like, how is Hedwig's theme, which is kind of the iconic entry point into the music and into the world itself, how does that change over the other movies?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's something that, like you said, I've written about and spoken about elsewhere. It's in the book, you know, when that comes out. But looking particularly at the opening sequences, so the very opening moments of each of the films from pressing play, Hedwig's theme is always the first kind of musical idea that we hear. And like I said, in the first film, we get it on horns with scurrying kind of violins all around it. The second time, third time, we get it in The Prisoner of Azkaban. It's kind of on Celeste at the same time as Harry's trying to do like Lumos quite well under the covers. Anyway, from that point on, we still get Hedwig's theme in the start of each of the films, but it becomes more and more diatonic, which is the opposite of chromatic. So all of those kind of interesting chromatic, kind of crunchy, kind of evocative notes start to become kind of naturalized or normal. normalized. Do is kind of, I think, how Patrick Doyle starts it in the fourth film. We've got time signature changes, so lots of different kind of changes where gradually it becomes more and more diatonic. And it's also kind of broken down in the way that I read it. If you sit and watch each of the opening sequences kind of back to back, you get less and less of Hedwig's theme. So I think by film five or six, you just get that first phrase. The seventh film, Deathly Hallows, you get the first phrase, but it's kind of very gradually transposed down. It's made to sound like it's on a kind of a music box, which is running out of wind, you know, and that it's kind of gradually degrading and rusting and breaking. And it actually gets completely overcome. If you watch the opening sequence for the kind of opening title for Deathly Hallows Part One, it gets completely overcome by the sound design. So you've got lots of sounds, which is kind of whispering parcel tongue. You've got the sound of a kind of a Horcrux whirring in the background, even though we don't really know that's what that sound is yet. And the sound of this Warner Brothers logo kind of gradually rusting and breaking in front of our eyes. All of these sounds completely kind of override Hedwig's theme, and it sort of is disappeared, it's broken down, to the point that actually in the eighth film, Deathly Hallows Part Two, it's not Hedwig's theme. We get Lily's theme. We get a brand new theme created by Alexandre Desplat only for this final film. And interestingly, I think Lily's theme can be heard, or I hear it as a kind of a new version of Hedwig's theme. It has a very similar structure in terms of the phrasing, you know, like an opening phrase, a following phrase. It's very similar in terms of where it starts on kind of the tonic or note. The kind of home note goes to the dominant halfway through, finishes on the tonic. So if you look at how they line up in lots of interesting ways. But also it's completely diatonic. There are no chromatic notes in Lily's theme whatsoever. And I think if you think about what that means, you know, we're moving from Hedwig to Lily, we're moving to a childhood pet to a lost parental figure, from kind of innocence to experience, from sort of childlike wonder to a very adult sense of loss, from chromaticism to diatonicism. All of this kind of gradual movement, it works alongside what we've discussed as the gradual darkening tone of the films and the kind of the maturing nature of the narrative as well. So I just think it's super interesting. I think it's really fun to look at.
Oh my gosh, yeah, it is super interesting. And just that the disintegration that you talk about is so well suited to the themes of the books, which, you know, there's this alchemical, you know, literary overlay over the whole, you know, that really encourages you to think about the hero, you know, having to totally break down and be kind of born anew, you know, through the course of his own heroism. That's really interesting. I wonder, you know, when you're doing this, Dan, what is your process? Like, so I know as a musician, I have to play music in order to really understand it. You know, I have to try to reproduce it in some way. Is that involved in your process, or how do you come to these conclusions?
Yeah, a really good question. I think sometimes I've developed a real familiarity with the soundtracks through listening anyway, before I come to kind of, I suppose, study it as such. So like with the Jurassic Park stuff, I was already kind of familiar with the big themes, but less so with the other films. So my process for studying is to, listen a couple of times through to soundtracks, making notes. I always sit and watch the film, making notes, so pausing it pretty much all the time. I can't sit with my wife to watch the films if I'm studying it, because I have to pause it and write stuff down for 30 seconds. And you know, I'm always listening, and I'll do that a couple of times through to a film, making notes about what I hear, which I think might be noteworthy. So like motifs or melodies, instrumentation, harmony, anything which I think is kind of interesting. And then sometimes if it's a bit more involved analysis, I might do some transcription. So often you can't get hold of particular scores for films. If you can get hold of any notation, it's probably an arrangement that's been made to play it on the piano or to for other ensemble or whatever. But generally, film scores don't really exist in published format. In fact, they probably existed at one point while they were recording it in the studio, and then all the parts got thrown away or archived somewhere, and it's not easy to access. There are some exceptions, but with The Lord of the Rings and the Harry Potter, there aren't, you know, published scores. And so it's transcribing moments where I think I need to really understand what's happening here. But generally, it doesn't really go too deep or too, you know, too kind of sophisticated or tricky, because I think what I'm interested in is what effect is the music having on the listener. And so I'm not interested in kind of bits of a score that require a PhD to understand what music is going on. I want to be thinking about how is everybody understanding and hearing this music? What effect is it having? And yeah, it is interesting to kind of uncover depths and details that show some real interesting craft. And that's fun too, to kind of uncover, like we've already discussed, some of these kind of, they're not secrets, but some of the craft and the thought and intention behind how these scores have been composed and the motifs, how they relate to one another, that kind of thing.
You know, I
That's
often
kind of
have
super fun.
students with literature. It's like they don't believe that an author really intended all the deep, like analytical bits of it that combine to create the whole thing. And you analyze it and they're like, oh, they didn't, that was an accident. And I feel like maybe that's with the music, right? You're revealing like this is intentional and there are particular ways that they're using sound to create this emotional connection or this thematic link. And just because you're not conscious of all of the bits that are going in, and you are, Dan, making, you know, helping us to see, but that, you know, it is intentional. And I was also really interested to see that you do also interview people about how they experience the music, and also people who are involved in creating and performing the music too.
So I think that's another part of I suppose my methodology, my kind of methodological process is, well, depending on what I'm looking at, you know, I like doing a lot of kind of film analysis. Sometimes that becomes a bit more involved in terms of kind of harmonic stuff, or motivic kind of relations. But then, yeah, I like engaging with fans as well, and doing some kind of ethnography, whether that's asking fans about their kind of soundtrack consumption, you know, like listening practices. How often do you listen to these soundtracks? What do they mean to you? But also engaging with other creatives who have been a part of kind of the world. And so, you know, haven't been able to interview John Williams or any of the other composers. I haven't really tried, because they're kind of often quite hard to get a hold of.
I
But
bet.
lots of other people that I
I
have been able
know.
to speak
George Lucas will not return my emails either. It's very disappointing to me.
to. You too. Oh, one day we'll get through.
One day.
But there's lots of people I have been able to speak to. So, like James Hannigan, who was the composer for the four later kind of well, video games that were a part of kind of coming out alongside the films. He's brilliant. I spoke to Martin Lowe, who is the music supervisor on The Cursed Child, who worked with Imogen Heap to create the music of that, and he was really, really helpful. And yeah, other people who've been involved in music in some of the kind of transmedia stuff that I've also looked at. So the theme parks, the studio tour in Watford, people who've made music for some of the theme park rides, you know, who have been like, I can speak to you. I've signed an NDA, so I can only say so much, but this is what I can tell you. So other people have been really forthcoming, and that's really interesting to be able to get access to the motivation or the brief that a sound designer or a composer was given. You know, where are these creative decisions being made? Who's making them, and kind of why are those being made? Because I'm looking at it from the listener's perspective, but I'm really interested in, like we said about intention, was that an intended similarity or was that circumstantial or whatever?
It's interesting what you say about the scores not being very readily available. It's surprising to me that that has not changed given the popularity of the Cine Concerts series, which, by the way, I am going to see Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part One, played by our local Columbus Symphony,
Yeah,
on
I was going to
Saturday.
say,
So
oh,
I'm
yeah.
so
So
excited.
one of my friends who works here, Chelsea. Thank you, Chelsea, for telling me about this. She just saw this weekend in Wheeling, they did Philosopher's Stone. And I was like, you have to tell me all about it. And so right before a podcast this morning, I was like, Chelsea, how was it? And the director was out front, like shaking people's hands and talking with people, and talked about just what a big fan he is, and just, you know, talking a little bit about how he's got these signals on a screen that show him when he's supposed to play for the, you know, for the movie. And she said she just got absorbed in it and forgot there was a live orchestra there at certain
You
points,
do
you
do
know?
that. We have gone to see everything since I just learned about them. Unfortunately, I missed the John Williams. No, maybe we saw, we might have seen we saw Prisoner of Azkaban, and it was excellent. And then and so I missed the first two, which was disappointing, but well, they're promising to do them all again. So I mean, because apparently they're kind of a big money maker, and I'm glad
Yeah,
to
they
see it.
must
It's
be.
wonderful. It's wonderful to look around and see the different people at the symphony, you
Yeah,
know,
and Chelsea
who
said this
wouldn't
one
be
was
there.
sold out, and with all the snow we've had, that's amazing.
They are fascinating. I went to one of the Cine concerts. It was the Philosopher's Stone, I think, when they were first touring it during my PhD research, which must have been like 2015 or 16 or so. And it's an amazing Yeah, experience. It's fascinating as something to research and study because you're looking around at like, people wearing their robes and cosplaying and like with owls and things. And then like, but also what I found was interesting is when people like whoop and cheer for certain characters, like the first time Harry or Hermione, like when people arrive, people would be cheering, but then people really cheered the first time Severus Snape, Alan Rickman, comes on. And it's like, it's fascinating because like if it's the first film, he's the bad guy for a while, spoiler alert, until you realize really what's going on by the end. But also Alan Rickman, I think, had died that year or the year before. And so there was also a kind of an extra filmic sense of we love and cherish and want to show our
Honoring
appreciation
him.
for not only the character, but also the actor. Same for John Hurt, got a big round of applause and he died at a similar time. So it was a really interesting kind of combination of worlds. You've got the fantasy world of the film. You have, in a sense, another world being created right in front of you musically by the orchestra. And for many people, that's quite a magical experience too. If you don't necessarily have a musical background or an awareness or appreciation for how each of these musical instruments works, you'll be looking at a whole bunch of people holding a whole bunch of objects that you may or may not recognize and be like, what's making that sound? And then you see who's making the sound, you go, wow, that's magical. So there's something magical about seeing an orchestra play and create a world anyway. And then you've got these worlds outside of it. I find it really fascinating.
Yeah, and Chelsea said
I
there were
will.
people who don't even who don't even seem like they are fans of Harry Potter, who just like
Yeah,
orchestras,
they
and they
just, they're
showed
symphony
too.
goers. So Dan, maybe this is a controversial question, but do you have a favorite piece of music, or do you think you could say all of them, or do you think there's one that you think has particular cultural significance?
Well, it's a very good question. There was one, so I really like John Williams's music for The Prisoner of Azkaban. I just think it becomes so varied and he starts to take it in some really interesting directions. And also he created a track which was on the end of the soundtrack, which I think is the music that plays over the end credits, but I'd have to verify that. There's a track on the soundtrack called Mischief Managed, which is basically a kind of a medley of like all of his big numbers from that film. And that's something I listened to, all a lot when I was in my teens. And so I think that means a lot to me because it was a part of me thinking, I really love film music if it can do all these things. It's so varied and it's so evocative and magical. Culturally, it's a tricky one because Hedwig's theme is obviously so, it's a signpost and a marker and a stand-in for the whole wizarding world, really. And that can never really be undone. You couldn't take Hedwig's theme out of all of the attractions and all of the experiences. But I do see some interesting things elsewhere in the franchise as well. So I think Cursed Child and the music of the play is entirely unrelated. It's completely kind of constructed of music by Imogen Heap from her back catalogue and some new stuff that she wrote, and Martin Lowe was also kind of playing with and working with some of that musical material to create the music for the play or the plays. And I think it's really interesting because the play creates a very different world. To an extent, it's related, but it's like in a different time. And the way that it tells the story is completely different. They're not saying, we're going to make this like a film experience. They're saying, this is theatre. This is how we do it in the theatre. And, this is what magic looks and sounds like. This is how we pronounce Voldemort. These kinds of things where there's subtle changes to sound and
That's
music.
the podcast approved pronunciation of Voldemort, by the way.
Oh,
That's the one
I'm
Katie and
glad
I
to hear
tend to use.
it.
So we're glad I'm glad to hear that that
Yeah.
that's also observed in
They must
Cursed
have been
Child.
listening when they were thinking about how to do it in
They
Cursed
must,
Child.
yeah. We're
But it's
influential that
interesting.
way. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. I think the music of, while we're on it, the music of Cursed Child is really interesting too, because there's some elements where an Imogen Heap fan would recognize, oh, this is music from that song. And will that bring other kind of connotations to what it did to me when I was sitting watching?
Right, or pull you out of the world. That's, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, there's a moment, and I won't, there's no spoilers, but there's a moment towards the end of the final act of the play where the music comes from a track by Imogen Heap called "Good Night and Go." Say good night and go, and it's not the melody; it's kind of some of the backing stuff. But I recognized it, and it was like interesting that if an Imogen Heap fan is there listening to the music, and the music is like "Say good night and go," like this is the end. Like it's kind of almost narratively, sort of lyrically telling you that it's coming towards the end. There's one point which I talked about elsewhere, maybe, but there's one point where I felt and heard a real similarity And I think it's circumstantial. I don't think that it was intentional, but there's a real similarity at one point in the Cursed Child play with the music, which feels very, very similar to Lily's theme by Alexandre Desplat. And some of your listeners may have seen the play and heard the music, but you can listen to the soundtrack as well. There's a point where there's a patronus, I don't know how you might pronounce it, I say patronus, on stage, and it's the shape of a doe, a deer, a female deer, in kind of like blue fire, you know. And the music at this point is it's a female, a solo female vocal. It's Imogen Heap singing on an oo or an ah sound, and it's all in a minor diatonic scale. So you can listen to it on the soundtrack for a much better performance than that. But for me, that is very much an extension of Lily's theme. It shares all the same sounds, vibes. It's in the same, roughly the same kind of minor collection, and that makes sense because it's Lily's patroness, you know. And so there's a logic to it, where if you're looking for those kind of similarities, maybe you can find them. I definitely found that quite interesting when I was watching it, and I wondered if other fans, who are, I suppose, more versed in the kind of music of the world, might also find those kinds of connections. But I don't think it's intentional. I think it's accidental, but it's still really interesting to see. So yeah, that was a bit of a tangent to your question.
Yeah, no, but I think that's really interesting. I was thinking about, you had written about this and how the people who were designing the music for the play were like, look, these people, like, they're standing in line singing the John Williams versions of the Harry Potter songs. And so we're going to do something different. We want them to know that there's a connection here, but it is its own kind of thing. And I thought that was a really interesting, like, d creative decision to make.
Yeah, it's definitely a bold one when you think at how kind of interrelated and quite similar the rest of the kind of entry points to the Wizarding World are. Like all of the films, all of the games have that kind of connection. Hogwarts Legacy has a very similar kind of musical feel and connection, and does make use of Hedwig's theme and some other kind of similarities. I'm playing through it at the moment with a view to try and write something about it eventually. So I'm still kind of getting to grips with how that music's working, but it does sound, you know, very similar. And so for Cursed Child to say we're creating a different experience and it's going to look and sound and feel quite different, is really interesting.
Yeah, I'm also really fascinated about how the music is incorporated into the games, and I love the idea that, like, the roller coasters are also using the music in interesting ways, and that that it again, and I do think, like, you're talking about how the theme park, but also the video games must do this as well. It's a way to extend your experience of this universe that you connect maybe with your childhood, or with a kind of ability to, you talk a little bit about escapism, right? To kind of escape into this world a little bit. And so it's interesting to think about how the music is maybe playing a role there.
And I think we can kind of talk about them both side by side, because both video games and kind of theme park attractions, they both extend the world in a way which makes it more interactive or immersive. Like there's a way in which we can engage, like we control the action in the video game, or we're moving around the theme parks or the studio tour like place. We're engaging with it in that way, in a quite an active way. And the music in each case, it's really detailed, you know. The amount of detail that has gone to in creating the music for each of these games, so to score those, and the way in which that's made to be responsive to the player kind of controls and movements, is really, really fascinating. So it was actually only up until the Jeremy Soule scored the first four games that came out alongside the films, and he wasn't able to use any of or quote any of the film material. So there's kind of allusions to it, but there's no quotation. James Hannigan from film Game 5 onwards was able to quote that, and he does, but he also moves away from it. He creates his own versions of Hedwig's theme, so you get more kind of subtle difference and detail from that point. And then in the theme parks, there's music everywhere. I've only been to the kind of Universal Studios and Islands of Adventure in Orlando, Florida, and I know there's others elsewhere, but there's music everywhere, piped all around. And it's interesting because, like I said, most of it comes from the first two, maybe three films, but there are exceptions. So when you're in Nocturne Alley, as part of the Diagon Alley area, you have more kind of, it seems obvious, but more dark, kind of more of the kind of later films, basically some more grown-up ideas, or some that are related to dark magic, but some that are related to loss. So some of the cues that we hear in Nocturnally include Severus and Lily, and some of the other kind of more loss-related ones. And it's really interesting. What we also have, which I really like in the theme parks, is kind of live music making. So what I might call, in a kind of a film term, diegetic, which means part of the world, part of the kind of diegesis, and that it takes a couple of different forms. So there's Celestina Warbeck is part of the novel's lore, the kind of story, but not features in the films at all. Maybe she might be on the there might be something on the radio where Mrs. Weasley's
I
listening
was
to the
going to say,
wireless,
it's
but
Mrs. Weasley's
maybe.
favorite,
She
so.
talks about her, I think, but I don't know if there's any music. But there's a performer, you know, there's a show that happens in Hogsmeade, wherever, where you can hear Celestina Warbeck and some backing singers. And then there's also a kind of a Hogwarts choir who are holding little puppet frogs, kind of toads, you know, like belching along. And they're kind of singing Double, Double, Toil and Trouble, plus a bunch of other songs that are imagined to be kind of Hogwarts school songs, in a kind of a sort of Pitch Perfect High School Musical kind of style. So that I think that's really interesting, because it sort of links into another thing I'm interested in, which is Wizard Rock. So the world of kind of
Yeah.
fan created Harry Potter inspired musics,
Yeah,
and
now
you know
we
there's
have
loads
done
to
an
say about that.
episode on Wizard Rock. We were not
Yeah,
late,
cool.
we're too late to that party, maybe, but yeah,
It's
that's
really
fun
interesting, because
too.
then music of the world, where actually fans, you know, and musicians start to take ownership of the story. They start to do interesting things with it and imagine new things. And you know, there's a big branch of Wizard Rock in terms of fandom that's had to grapple with, just as a lot of the fandom has grappled with J.K. Rowling. You know, there's elements of actually making music which is kind of, I was going to say reclamative, I don't think that's a word, reclaiming, reclamatory, whatever.
I deem it now a word.
Thank you. You
Yeah.
know, in that way of like really owning that expression of fandom, and doing music, using music to do that, I find really interesting as well. So
Yeah, that was a big motivator for us with our podcast, because the question is, how do we evoke Harry Potter with the music while avoiding copyright infringement? And it's so
it's
we
tricky.
that's my goal, was to try to transform the works so that one of my favorite ones, if I can say that one of my favorite ones, is the third task. We do my band does it kind of like a little bit of a hillbilly romp, and it's a lot of fun, and but it's very recognizable. It's almost like Hootenanny music, but it's a very recognizable theme. So, and it's one of my favorites. That's one of my favorite themes from the
Yeah,
because
and
it's very bright and fun, but it's something dark is really happening when the band comes back in, when Harry and
I was going to
Cedric arrive
mention,
again. It's like, oh,
that moment where the band is playing at the end, like that is moment where what's happening is totally out of sync with the music in a way that doesn't happen a lot there. And I just think of that all the time as this, when that starts to, it's so upsetting. Like
It's
if
a
you were talking about,
wrongness. Yeah,
yeah,
it's a
it's
real
just
wrongness, and it
very,
hits you. It's like, oh
yeah.
no, there's nothing to celebrate here. Oh my gosh,
It's
yeah, oh no, man.
a fascinating moment, and I've never really thought about that. So the Goblet of Fire film is interesting, because that has by far the biggest number of instances of what we call diegetic music. So it's got like the orchestra at the Yule Ball. It's got Jarvis Cocker and the Weird Sisters at the Yule Ball. It's got the brass band and things, and these invented instruments. But thinking about that moment just now, you know, it's almost as if the point where he comes back with the portkey and Cedric has died, that's the ruptural point in the world, isn't it? That's the point where death has gone past the doorstep and it has entered Hogwarts, you know, like, and it's that point where maybe in a sense, to an extent, the brass band is still kind of representing the sort of the enjoyment, the pomp, the safety of let's all just have a nice time and kind of do magic and compete, and just there'll be dragons, but they'll be safe enough.
Yeah, we'll
And
still be
then
kids.
We're still children. And then death arrives, and it's like it takes a while for everybody to realize. And I forget the actor's name, but Cedric's dad is, I can still hear him screaming, "My son," you know, like it's such a
I know.
performance,
I'm thinking about it
isn't
right now as we're talking about it.
it?
It's awful. Oh my gosh.
Well, and it's like, well, that's the reality of death and trauma and loss, is that the same things, the same music that you heard before that so invigorated you now just sounds wrong and just sounds, and it's, oh, it really just captures that so beautifully. Well, we hope we reclaimed the tune at least.
Ask a little bit.
Absolutely.
Happy, joyful Harry Potter conversation.
I don't know if you've listened to our intro and outro music, Dan, but Hedwig's Funky Feathers is our little jazzy riff on.
Well, I love it. I think,
of course,
I've heard
nothing
some of the
to
intro,
do with Hedwig's theme.
I'm going to listen more.
Totally copyright legit. So, Dan, how does the use of music by the Harry Potter cultural machine compare to the Lord of the Rings franchise? We have a lot of overlapping fans. Do you think the fantasy aspect of these stories makes the musical hook or the atmosphere more important than in stories with real-world settings?
Yeah, I think it does. I think that in any particular fantasy setting, particularly thinking filmically, the film or text is asking the viewer to make a comparatively larger step from their kind of primary world into a world which is perhaps more different in whatever way, whether that's chronologically or because it's completely a secondary world. And so I think music often helps to smooth over that process, you know, in terms of the transition from your own world into the film watching the film world. And for me, it's musical and sonic world building. So the world needs to be coherently built, whether that's the Wizarding World or whether that's Middle Earth, not only the music that happens outside of it that tells us how it should sound and how it feels, but also any music that happens within it or sound. So, you know, like what spells sound like needs to be coherent throughout. And so that's just what makes the world believable. I actually think the musical world building in The Lord of the Rings, so the work that Howard Shore does, particularly on Peter Jackson's Lord of the Ring trilogy, although it does also feature in the Hobbit trilogy, it may be a little bit less kind of detailed perhaps, but it's on an even more epic scale and it, to some extent even more impressive in terms of networks of interrelated themes and motifs, the use of instrumentation and so on. What Howard Shore creates with his scores for The Lord of the Rings is vastly detailed, hugely epic, and stands up again to that kind of digging and scrutiny. If you look for some of those interrelations, there's some really fascinating things that come to the fore, not just through use of instruments, but related motifs or kind of harmonic movements and things like that. And so, yeah, but I think it doesn't necessarily, definitely doesn't mean that the scores for the Harry Potter series are kind of any worse off. I think that they're two very, very different film series in that there is such a significant change from film one to film eight in the Harry Potter series. And because of that, it requires a change and a shift in the scores. Similarly, because the director and the directorial kind of choices also change. And so it would be weird to have all of the films with all of their differences and the nuances, but with John Williams trying to score them all. You know, I think it did need that sort of change and shift, and each of the composers brings something quite different, quite new. I think I really love John Williams and really love Alexandre Desplat's stuff, because his stuff at the end is, he sees it as a very different type of film, and he scores it in that way, and I think that's to the film's kind of improvement.
I was thinking too about
its improvement.
You know, when I talk with people who, you know, who like both, but they're not really huge fans of either one, and sort of think about the differences. And I think The Lord of the Rings is epic. I mean, it's just, and you can see it with the cinematography as there are these giant shots of them, you know, little tiny people walking across mountains and so on. And Harry Potter's more domestic, right? And its evils are a little bit, they're closer, they're like familial in a way. And like, it's just on a grander scale, the whole Lord of the Rings series. It is a kind of saga in a way that the Harry Potter stories are not. And so I think some of those aspects of the music just might be coming through in what you were talking about as well, with the way the scores are produced.
Yeah, absolutely. The music of The Lord of the Rings is being asked to music a whole host of different, not just characters, but people groups, races, communities that are far apart, you know, maybe distantly related or historically related, but have grown to be quite different over several millennia. But Harry Potter is being asked to music individuals and their interrelationships and very specific locations that aren't kind of whole cities or whole regions or areas, but are like one common room or one building or whatever that is. So it is, like you say, much more domestic. It's much more about, well, they're both about home. The way I see them both is they're both about home.
Yeah, so I wondered if you could...
The narratives are similar.
If you can give us a little preview of what you say, I love the subtitle of your book, The Sounds of Home. And it's interesting because both of those series are mostly set not at home. And so I wondered, like, what is your, what is it that you hear in terms of the sounds of home in those two series?
So it really kind of came through a lot of my work on my PhD thesis when I was thinking, well, what's going on here, like on a deeper level? What's the music doing? What job, what role is it playing? What's it representing? And actually thinking about different theorizations of home became a really useful way of theorizing, okay, what's this music standing in for? And so I think about that. There's a whole chapter in the book on home and home spaces, whether that's a kind of a home that is being fought for. So whether that's Hogwarts as a kind of a surrogate home, really, for Harry and the community, or the Shire. But then there's different home spaces that they stay in as well, which provide kind of shelter, whether that's kind of 12 Grimmauld Place or the Burrow, you know, two very different homes, but they're still homes, or different Rivendell and different homes that we might have in The Lord of the Rings. And then home, kind of home as a stand-in for the whole community. So really they're fighting not only for kind of Hogwarts and the Shire, but they're fighting for all of Middle-earth, or they're fighting for the whole wizarding world, you know, the whole of the wizarding community, because the stakes start to get higher and higher as you move through the narratives. And so it's an interesting frame to put the music within that, because I can think about, okay, what is the music of each of these home spaces? How are they depicted to sound homely, to sound safe, to sound inviting, or not? You know, are they depicted? So like 12 Grimmauld Place has basically no music in it. There is no magic in there, you know, like, oh, well, there is magic, but there is no kind of sense of homeliness in there. The one bit of music that we do have in 12 Grimmauld Place at one point is where
Is it
Hermione is
Hermione
teaching
and
Ron
Ron
to
or
play Ferraliz on the piano. And that's a
But
very,
that's
very recognizable human, non-magical, you know, it's not a magical piano. She's trying to teach him to do something
right. And
with his actual fingers.
that song is it's you know the da 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 right. That has a it's a
It's
bittersweet.
chromatic. That's got some chromaticism, and it's probably something that lots of people will recognize and have sat down to play on the piano at some point. You know, it's so well known and famous. So, what's I thinking about home? And also, but the other way I think about home is, okay, people are listening to these soundtracks a lot. You know, they're using this music to inhabit the world in some way, whether that's the wizarding world, or Middle Earth. They're using the music to have that kind of imaginative experience. For some people, you know, in a very, very deep personal, even spiritual sort of level. And so I'm also thinking about, okay, if these worlds become homes that you are inhabiting or escaping into, how does that work? You know, what are those processes outside of just film watching? So yeah, soundtrack listening and consumption and fan musics, you know, people coming together to make music of these worlds, or which is related to these worlds. That's also creating a home, a safe space, or a way to express fandom in some way. So home kind of ties it all together in some way.
And I was thinking about because as I said, I was really intrigued by how you talked about nostalgia in your work. And nostalgia originated as it was supposed to be homesickness. It was not a time, it was not time sickness. It was like longing for home, these Swiss soldiers, I guess, who were homesick, and they called that nostalgia. And so I find it really interesting, this, this idea that home and a certain time are then, brought together in this nostalgia. And so that sort of longing for home and maybe a home of the past or a home of childhood that maybe doesn't exist anymore, and the way that the music is evoking that in the film, but then also it's having an effect on us, the viewers, the listeners, as we then associate that with something in the past or some kind of home type experience.
I think it is definitely about home, for me at least. And yeah, it's interesting that the root of that nostalgia is similar to the German term Heimweh, I think it is. So it's a very similar, like a longing for a home or a sense of home. And I remember, you know, I'm not a really, really strong Harry Potter fan, but I remember each time going to the cinema, watching each as a teen or whatever, watching each of these films and then coming out and being disappointed that it wasn't real. I couldn't actually go and visit, you know. And that sense of longing for enchantment, that sense of longing for a magical kind of counterpart to Great Britain, or a magical kind of escape, you know, that is longing for a sense of home. I think To go on a deeper level, we're all experiencing some level of kind of cultural homelessness. Like, there's lots of things which are showing the home as being not always the safest place, or like we're thinking about home in different ways, having been locked down in them a few years ago. The ways in which we think of home and the things that we long for as part of our experience of home, I think interacts with the impulse, the fantasy impulse, and the impulse to kind of inhabit and explore these kind of fantasy worlds. And I really, really think that music is one way in which we kind of scratch that itch. It's one way in which we imaginatively kind of escape to those places, and we enjoy it. I don't think that escapism is a negative thing. I don't think it's trying to run away from everything, although it can be. It can be kind of consolidation or sort of solace. It can be a way of processing emotion and figuring out how we see the world and identity formation. It can be all those things. But music is a way in which we do that, and that's what I suppose I'm really interested in.
Yeah, that's neat. A Tolkien says, who blames the prisoner for trying to escape the prison? Like of course we want an escape from the things that are terrible in our world, and that's not somehow lesser. That's an attempt at, I think Emily had said earlier, at transcendence. And that's a real fundamental part of the human quest for transcendence. And the music, I'm so fascinated by everything you said about how music is able to do that for us. So Dan, what's next for you? What are you doing? You've got this book coming out, and then what else are you looking at these days?
The book's coming out, and I've got some last bits and bobs to do that on proofs and things. I'm actually on a period of sabbatical research leave, which is amazing, that I'm
Nice.
afforded that by the institution. So I've
Yeah.
got some plans. The next thing for me is going to be a project on the music of children's media, particularly looking at kind of early years TV. I've got two young kids of my own, and so I've been surrounded by lots of early years TV for the last 5 years. And so I'm really interested in how composers for early years TV series kind of introduce children to some of these same musical ideas. How do we decode? How do we learn to decode film and TV music so that when we hear a certain sound or instrument or a certain combination of sounds, we know that that's a bad guy or a good guy, or it's funny or it's tense or it's embarrassing. I want to do an article on the music of Bluey. I haven't really told anyone that yet,
I
but that's
love
going to be
Bluey.
probably
I was actually
my
going to ask
first
you about
step.
Bluey.
I want to do Bluey. I think Bluey is absolutely brilliant, and I'd love to talk with Geoff Bush about his music on that. There's a lot I think I could say, and I'm going to try and put an article of that. I'm also going to write a chapter on Sufjan Stevens and his Christmas music collections, which is a little bit different for a chapter. So I've got some different things to keep me busy, I
That
think.
sounds
So yeah,
great.
it's
Oh,
an
I could
exciting
talk about the
time.
children's stuff too. When you've got kids, you end up, and like we would put CDs in the radio, that were just so the kids would be entertained. And we listened a lot to the Yo Gabba Gabba CD. I don't know
Oh
if you know
yeah.
Yo Gabba Gabba, if they
I've
even play
heard of
that
it.
anymore, but they had all kinds of like wild songs, but very very modern. They were very of the time. So it wasn't horrible. Some of it's not good, but the Yo Gabba Gabba stuff, I was like, I'll listen to that.
That's pretty cool. My two are really into the Trolls films,
Oh, sure.
Anna
Oh,
Kendrick and
yeah.
Justin Timberlake. And there's about five of those films now. So there's enough different soundtracks that we can cycle through and don't get bored of just one of them. But they're good because a lot of them, it's all covers of like big hits, Earth, Wind and Fire or whatever else is on there. So it feels like I'm also introducing them to good music at the same time as it being stuff that they love. So
It
it's
can
all
be
good fun.
done.
Yeah, that's what's next,
Oh,
really.
that's awesome. That sounds great. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks a lot, Dan.
Oh, thank you. No worries. And I've
Great.
thought of some new things as well. I've learned a bit and had some kind of brainwaves and insights, so it might end up in some next publications as well.
Oh,
Thank you so
great.
much.
Yeah, and sure, I'll be sure to pick up a copy of your book. I just think it's fascinating, and I've loved the work that I've read from you so far. Just really interesting on so many different levels. So glad we got a chance to talk to you. Our closing quote today comes from Headmaster Albus Dumbledore, self-professed admirer of chamber music. In Philosopher's Stone, after everyone at Hogwarts sings the school song to their favorite tune, whatever that might be, Dumbledore says, wiping his eyes, "Ah, music, a magic beyond all we do here.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.